Hello everyone and welcome back to Family Forever Child's Conversations on Care podcast. My name's Amanda Griffith and I'm the CEO of Family Forever Child. This podcast is a space where we can talk directly to practitioners about how they are providing care to vulnerable children and families around the world. At Family Forever Child, we are a growing network of currently 42 local civil society organisations working on the ground in 38 countries. And these organisations have a wealth of knowledge and experience from years of working with children and communities to develop solutions to improve children's care. Today's podcast is the second episode in our Power of Civil Society mini-series, where we are looking at the positive outcomes that occur when civil society organisations come together and collaborate. This series supports the launch of Changemakers for Children, our online platform that aims to create a strong global community of civil society organisations to create lasting change for children around the world. Today we're focusing on the topic of research, and I'm delighted to be joined by Suzanne Clulow from the City Children in Distress Network, known as CINDI, in South Africa. CINDI is a diverse network of over 250 South African civil society organisations championing the rights of vulnerable children and their families. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you, Amanda.
And thank you very much for joining me in this conversation. So Suzanne, back in 2015, CINDI was involved in a joint research project with two other Family Forever Child members that looked at the linkages between social protection and children's care in sub-Saharan Africa. The research culminated in the Cash for Care report that was published in 2016. Suzanne, I'd like to start by asking you to tell us how this joint research project came about.
Thanks, Amanda. Yes. I think there were sort of three branches that came together around that time. The first was obviously a growing discourse around social protection, and in particular looking at the issues of cash plus care. Initial scoping literature review revealed that there was quite a considerable gap around studies that looked at the impact of social protection on children's care and child protection issues. So, for example, topics such as family separation or child marriage or birth registration. There were very few studies that looked at that compared to studies that looked at the impact of social protection on nutrition and health outcomes, for example. And then also, a growing concern in particular of that area in sub-Saharan Africa where the issues of family separation and the high numbers of children that either were already separated or were at risk of being separated. And then particularly in the two countries, there were some new social protection cash transfer programs that the government was busy implementing that were sort of new and innovative. That was in Ghana and Rwanda, where two members of family were based. And then in South Africa, this already well-established social protection system, not without its own problems and its own challenges, which also was interesting to look at. And so this sort of idea was kind of birthed between the members within family who expressed an interest in participating that based on an identified gap. Then we approached IDS, the Institute for Development Studies, based at the University of Brighton, and a discussion started and the research was developed.
Great. So basically what you were looking at, you've identified a gap. You've also looked at there's timely government change where you could influence, and really three different contexts and yet a common gap of research that needed to be fulfilled. So in terms of that, what was the purpose or the added value of coming together to design and conduct a joint research on this topic rather than doing your own individual research as separate organisations?
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, obviously, it's easier to do it individually, but the absolute value of working together is obviously, particularly looking at a region or an area with a particular gap that's been identified, the stronger the voice, the more countries involved, the more people involved, the stronger that voice can be around that issue. I also think that it's a great opportunity for learning from each other. It was three very different contexts and three very different programs. And, you know, eventually we did come together with members of the different governments from those three countries, and actually also a fourth country, because we launched the joint work in Nairobi. And we were able to then share across that those government platforms around learnings and interventions and, you know, successes, challenges. And I think because of that, there was a lot more learning than if we'd just done it on our own.
Really interesting. So that whole, and the added value, therefore, of being able to look at a regional influence rather than just at the national, and that intersection between national can be influenced by regional can be influenced by national. So getting that sort of greater voice and influence, but also, as you say, that benefit of learning from different contexts. So sort of being able to talk to government not only from the national context, but with reference to other sort of environments in which you can actually enable change to happen. So all three organisations were carrying out a literature review and participant interviews and focus groups in your own communities and your own countries. Once the work was underway, at what points did you come back together as a group, and how did that add to the sort of shape of the overall project and the outcome?
Yeah, so we had obviously during the planning stages, there were several meetings, and then we went away, as you said, and collected our individual research. And then we came together again virtually and also in person to do a joint data analysis. So we'd all analysed our data at national level, and we understood what that meant for us nationally. And then we came together and said, okay, but what does this mean for the regional work? And if we look at the regional literature review that was done and some of the concerns and advocacy issues that were raised from that, what does our research say about that? And then that led to a series of planning meetings and online meetings where we made decisions about what we thought would be best to do with that information and how best we could advocate to the region. And so the decision was made to hold a joint meeting to launch the synthesis report of the research in Nairobi. And Nairobi was chosen as a sort of strategic position and a strategic city within Africa and within the African Union. And so we came together, and as I mentioned previously, we invited members of our different governments, representatives from our different governments, to participate in those meetings. And so it was done on kind of three levels. It was a launch in Nairobi for interested organizations and key stakeholders within Nairobi from some of the bigger NGOs that have offices there, as well as the Kenyan government. And then also an opportunity to bring our government representatives together for the launch. And then post the launch, we also held a sort of roundtable meeting with those different government representatives and ourselves. And we discussed within our own countries and potentially regionally, what else could we do? What were the learnings? What had been useful to them about this process? And what would they then take forward? And could we support at national level to work on further within our different contexts?
Brilliant. So one of the things was sort of the importance of having a synthesis report. So not just here are three different national findings, but also what's that starting to tell us at a regional level. Then and actually thinking strategically, so where within our regional context, our sub, you know, within our continental environment, the sub-Saharan Africa, where's the most strategically for us to start to really voice and share the findings for this meeting? So choosing Kenya as your location, but also importantly, it sounds like a really interesting marriage of local civil society organizations working with an academic institute and then really partnering up with government to come together through this round table to start to talk about, so what are the findings here and what changes can we make? So it sounds like it's not just what you're having to think about is research content and methodology, but also much more strategically about how can the evidence for this really be able to achieve significant change. And by bringing together those partners and thinking strategically about location and sharing of findings, that Is that your sense that that managed to really strengthen what you could have achieved through the research itself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the deciding where to host that synthesis meeting was quite a big deal, as you've mentioned. It was trying to think where would be a strategic place, but also perhaps a neutral place for the best impact in terms of particularly the government representatives coming and not feeling like they're coming on a host exchange, meeting. So it was, we tried specifically to be neutral in the location. And I do think that, in fact, the government representatives, a relationship grew between them, but a relationship also grew between the country members and their government representatives, because it was done in a very, there's a lot of dialogue and a non-threatening way. And I think that the choice of location made a big difference to that. If we'd held it in one of the countries, for example, I think that would have presented a different picture and perhaps been a little bit more threatening to some government representatives. I think absolutely. And of course, as you mentioned, the synthesis report was key, and having IDS on board, who'd already worked in several of those countries and, you know, were well known and well respected for their work on social protection. I think it was a really good marriage of the different levels. And because of that, I think it had a lot of impact. I know certainly in all three countries, the recommendations that were made were listened to and taken up by the various governments. So it made a big difference.
So looking on the other side of the coin there, were there any challenging moments that arose out of working together? I mean, you're three member organisations obviously operating in very different parts of Africa, South Africa, Ghana and Rwanda. Is there anything that sort of that came through in terms of the challenges that happened in trying to work together in a collaborative and reach that synthesis report particularly, and anything in reflection you might have done differently?
Yeah, it's also another good question. I don't know if there's anything we would have done differently, but it certainly was some of the findings were, I guess you could almost say, a little bit contradictory because of the different country contexts, which is always going to happen when you do research across different contexts, even within the same country, it can happen. So that meant that when we were pulling together our synthesis report, we had to be very clear and careful about what we chose from each of those countries so that it didn't appear to somebody that we were sort of cancelling out one finding with the finding from another country. I know, for example, in particular in Ghana, that there was concerns around the number of children that could receive the cash transfer, and the suggestion was to not limit it, whereas in South Africa it's limited, and that was, wasn't a recommendation that should change because it didn't come up as a concern from the participants. So, those are kind of some of the more detailed nuances that are particular to a context. So one always has to be aware of those kind of issues coming up when you're doing a joint research. So that made sometimes some of the, deciding on what we were going to include in the synthesis report a little bit tricky. It was also tricky working with the different governments because three very different countries, very different sizes, and governments with very different approaches. So that was also tricky because we had deadlines and it got a little bit stressful at a few points about who was going to be there and if somebody was going to be there. And particularly from our side, it was a bit more, there's a lot more protocol, maybe I can say, to go through to allow a government representative to travel outside of South Africa representing their department. That it wasn't necessarily something we would do different, but it was definitely a challenge of the research. And I'm glad we persevered because I think it's built relationships that even till today, we still refer back to those relationships sometimes when we need additional advocacy support.
Really interesting. And that's fantastic to draw out that contradictions aren't necessarily a way of negating the research. What you've got to bring through is the nuance of saying context matters, and therefore different solutions are needed in different contexts and in different phasings and things. So actually giving value to the diversity that came through to say this is why it's really important that you conduct local national research, because that can really inform where are you currently and what is the situation and what changes need to happen. And they may actually be completely contradictory what was needed in different places, but that is equally valid. And the importance of being able to say that bringing those points together is to give value to the nuance rather than diluting for simplicity. And that really kind of speaks a bit to my next question, Suzanne, which is how do you think the research findings were different because it was conducted by local civil society organisations who traditionally are not necessarily seen as the national organisations that would conduct research that would then influence government? It tends to be more with academic institutes or large UN agencies and international agencies, but this was very much conducted by local CSOs. What do you think was different about how did that contribute to the research to have local CSO knowledge driving this and things? And what was the added value of Cindy and Usenga Nyamianzi and in Rwanda and Changing Heights in Ghana? What was it in terms of that research?
I think probably I would say it was around two levels. And the first would be relational. So those are organizations that are based in the area, working with people already, and so are more recognized and known perhaps than some of the larger academic or, UN agencies that might come in. And I think that really helped to establish more of a rapport with the participants. And so perhaps maybe in some instances more honesty. And also because the organizations were totally independent of the schemes that, the cash transfer programs that were being implemented, they would have been seen as neutral. And so participants, I would say, would feel more comfortable responding more transparently than if they felt like somehow there was going to be some sort of change made to the program or to their personal cash transfer based on the responses that they gave. Mm. So I think that relational aspect is really important in terms of what people feel comfortable telling you. And then I also just think the nuanced knowledge of those particular tricky little things that come up with cash transfer schemes that, at the bigger policy level, of course, people are thinking about issues of conditionality and issues of targeting, et cetera, et cetera. But on the ground, some of those don't transfer so readily because of cultural issues or understanding of the program, education levels around what the cash transfer is and who it's intended for. And so I think, being able to be based and understand some of those issues really helps when you're interpreting the data and the responses as well from people. So for example, in South Africa, something that came up quite a lot with our data was what we call othering. And it's this idea that I would use the cash transfer for the good of my child, but other people would use it and waste it on having their hair done or drinking or something frivolous in other people's minds that's not for children. And there's no research to support that notion, but it is a very common response among people because there are some people who may do that, but generally they are the exception to the rule. The vast majority of caregivers in South Africa are using the money to care for their children. But if you were to just read the responses from participants, then you might, if you weren't more aware of that local context, you might raise that as a very big concern. Mm. It was included in our research, but we did put a proviso in there, explaining that this has come up in other research in South Africa and that there isn't really any scientific, research evidence to support this notion, but people have this concept that someone else would do that, whereas they wouldn't. So that's just an example of local knowledge that we were able to then say, actually, yeah, this is something that comes up, but it's not necessarily the truth for everybody.
Brilliant. That's really interesting. So the combination of what the local CSOs already have, which is that the existing relationships, the relationships of trust, and also I think the word that you use, which is so important, is that they are seen as an independent and neutral. So they're there for the community. They're not going to, and then particularly when you're asking people to share insights into things whereby, as you say, the potential could be that your research, they don't know, that your research could have led to changes that would have been detrimental for them personally. So it was crucial to get a full and honest insight, was that people trusted who the organisation was that was conducting the interview and actually engaging in the research. And then I think the other piece, which is so interesting, is also this really important thing that those that are participating in research need also to bring that incredible insight that you can only have if you are actually part of that context, so that you can genuinely see, what do I understand around the information and analysis that I'm giving it? So how can I enrich what the research findings are by being able to provide that broader context within which to situate the actual findings that came through. So both of those really incredibly important to enabling us to have really robust research, and yet probably only or more strongly possible to have if it's local CSOs who are conducting those discussions with communities. That's really insightful. Thanks, Suzanne. And although this particular podcast is really based on research, but you already alluded to it, and I think it's really important that advocacy is really a necessary and important outcome of research. The point of research in isolation doesn't achieve real change. Whereas if you can use that evidence base to then inform your advocacy, that's how the wider multiplying effect can happen of achieving wider change. And I wonder if you could just sort of share with us your sort of thinking about the importance of how the advocacy opportunities that this research brought to you. So that beautiful combination of evidence base enhancing advocacy, advocacy enhancing the research that's been undertaken.
Yes, Amanda, I think you've just highlighted a really important point that needed to spelling out more clearly. I think it's absolutely true that for local CSOs, I can speak for Cindy in particular, but our purpose of doing research is not just for research itself. It's because we want to be able to influence practice and policy. And whenever we engage with research, that's always what is at the front of our mind. If we do this, can we then engage further to influence policy and practice around this issue? And if we can't, then this research is not for us. So I think that's a really, it is definitely one of the strengths of having local CSOs involved. So for Cindy, this was really our first large piece of research, and it's definitely been a launching pad for us to get more involved in advocacy, particularly around social protection. And that has grown particularly to focus now on caregivers looking after children who are kin, so kinship care. And that came out specifically because when we were doing the research, we looked at the difference between two cash transfers in South Africa, one that is aimed at children who are in foster care and one that is aimed at children who are in the care of a primary caregiver, but not placed legally by the court. So the child support grant and then the foster child grant are the two different cash transfers we were looking at. And what has happened in South Africa and has been a point of advocacy for over 15 years, 20 for some people, is that there's been a kind of blurring of the lines between the child protection system, which is the foster child grant for children placed in foster care, and those children living in kinship care who may not be in need of care and protection through the child protection system, but who are in need of a cash transfer for financial support. And this has come around because South Africa has a very high burden of orphans in the country because of our HIV and AIDS pandemic, and potentially also now because of COVID. And so, you know, it's looking at how we kind of tidy up that situation a little bit, because it's become unsustainable for the child protection system, which is designed to cater for 50,000 children in need of care and protection, and currently has over 500,000 in that system. And so it's just created a total administrative overburdening for social workers. And actually the government, the Department of Social Development, has actually been taken to court in South Africa and is currently under a high court order, which is holding them to account for sorting out and providing a legal solution, basically a long-lasting legal solution to this blockage within the foster care system, the child protection system in South Africa. And so because of our research and then further research that we've done on kinship care, we've been able to really strongly advocate from a practitioner's point of view to say, look, we've spoken with people who are in receipt of these cash transfers, and here's what they're saying. And that's really been helpful to kind of, you know, flesh out some of the policy issues that are hard for people to understand until you put it into like a practical example of what someone experiences within that system. And that's been what's been so useful for us in terms of the research. And it's also obviously raised the profile of our organization, which means that we can then advocate at higher levels to have the voice of the participants in the research heard at higher levels. So next week, for example, we will be making a presentation, an oral presentation to Parliament on the reforms to certain policies which are in support of a cash transfer specifically for kinship carers. So it would then be allowing kinship caregivers who qualify for the foster child grant, but who are not able to access that cash transfer, which is higher than the one that they're currently receiving. They're not able to access it because the system is so overburdened with administration requirements that the social workers just are not able to assist people. And so we are advocating for a more simplified system that does not require a court order to place that child in kinship care, for children who've already been living in kinship care with their kinship caregivers for, you know, a longer period of time. They will now just be able to apply for that grant through SASA, which is a grants administration body of the Department of Social Development in South Africa.
Amazing. Well, good luck with that. I hope it goes well. But that's a fantastic story of, I guess, if somebody said to you in 2015, is that where you think you're going to end up? You probably would not have known. And that's the beauty, isn't it, of that sort of, it wasn't research in isolation. It was research because of a gap, a sense of an advocacy need, but then to use that evidence to inform the advocacy, that advocacy then starting to transpire to say, actually, this is having other implications. We need to undertake research on this. And then to be able to bring that whole passage of 6 years of work to be able to bring really tangible combination of research evidence and the voice of those who with whom this matters, those the participants in your research and the wider communities in which they're in, to be able to bring that to a poignant moment in government timing to be able to then to influence a change in government. And you would not have known that opportunity was there in 2015, but because you've thought strategically throughout, it means you're really, really well placed to be able to affect change when there's that moment that opens up within government change and rethinks, which is incredible. Fantastic example, very powerful. Thank you, Suzanne, so much. Really insightful, very interesting. an excellent opportunity for us to understand better why research and developing an evidence base really strengthens local civil society organisations and their capacity to influence. So thank you for sharing so openly about Cindy's experiences of a successful collaborative research project between local CSOs and really bringing out for us the importance of that. The sort of iterative process of research informs advocacy, advocacy must inform research, and being able to think strategically throughout about why am I conducting this research, what change is it I'm wanting to achieve, and then how can I affect that change most strategically in thinking about things like location for hosting roundtables, but also that partnership, the partnership between local civil society organisations, a reputable academic institute with existing relationships, and then the bringing government with you as a partner in the change, and sort of how that's really demonstrated that with all of this, the value of the local civil society organisations bringing those relationships of trust, which means that the evidence has real credibility and authenticity and is able to bring the local context to bear in terms of influencing policy change at the national level, but I'm sure also looking to see what regional changes can happen. So thank you, Suzanne, and thank you to those who've been listening for joining us to listen to this Conversationing on Care podcast. In the next episode of this Power of Civil Society podcast mini-series, I'll be speaking with Zeni Rosales from the Centre for the Prevention and Treatment of Child Sexual Abuse in the Philippines. And she'll be talking about joint advocacy work and the up-and-coming CSO-led Blue Umbrella Day campaign, which is raising awareness of how better care for and protect boys from sexual violence. You can sign up to receive alerts of new podcasts and other activities via the How We Care website at www.howwecare.community. And if you'd like to join our community platform for local CSOs, please go to the changemakersforchildren.community and register. The more users, the stronger we will be together. We hope you will join us next time. Thank you very much and goodbye.